Okay, we're good. There we go.
Good morning, Mr. Taylor. We're here at the offices of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition with John Taylor, President and CEO, and Josh Silver. From the FCSC, we have Alexis Simmendinger and Ron Borzakowski. I'm the Deputy Research Director currently at the Commission. For the record, the Commission was established by statute, signed into law by the President. We have 10 commissioners, all currently outside of government. It is a bipartisan commission, and our primary responsibility is to look backwards to understand the causes of the financial crisis.
Well, we should have been recording. You don't have to put well.
our report to the President and to Congress.
Do you actually record? Do you when is everything said recorded, or just you edit it?
Oh, well, the recordings will live for part of the oral history of this project for forever.
Okay, all right. So I'll watch what I say. I'll clean up my my vocabulary.
Yeah,
I don't feel that you need to.
You well, it's on our part.
It's just that anybody who's lived through this has got to be damn mad. Mad as hell.
Yeah.
And mad as hell at the stories that are being told about what happened. Because, you know, I've lived and worked through this from the beginning. We were there when we were warning people in the Clinton administration about these loans, warning them, you know, the OTS, and telling them, look, there are loans that are just unsustainable being made that are going to cause people problems. And then, of course, much more so in earnest under the Bush administration when things really began to take off, meeting with Bernanke, meeting with Greenspan, meeting with Dugin and who was the predecessor? John Hawke and all these different people in the agencies to try to explain to them the catastrophe that was coming. And, you know, to the credit of some people, they in Congress, they finally started to listen and started to understand, perhaps not until things collapsed, but they began to understand the role that predatory and unsafe and unsound lending played in creating this debacle, this financial collapse. And so they did things like pass an anti-predatory lending law, something we tried to do under Sarbanes when Sarbanes was still head of the Senate Banking Committee. Or actually when he was the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, he proposed bills that would have ended this these practices. But there was a single human being who you almost never read about. I mean, people like to point fingers and blame people. The irony is that the single biggest contributor to this financial collapse and to this foreclosure crisis, to this calamity of excessive greed and abusive lending, the single biggest contributor was Senator Phil Graham of Texas. As head of the Senate Banking Committee, that guy personally stood in front of every effort and prevented every effort to rein in these abusive lending practices. You know, people like to blame the victim. It's all they should have known better. And of course, you know, people maybe who have been in homeownership for a while, who have mortgages, and 9.9% of whom, 9.9 out of 10 have a prime loan and really have never had any experience with a predatory lender or a high-cost lender, and so they don't really know what happens in that process. But I can tell you that, you know, if you want to blame the people and say, well, they should have known better, that's, of course, someone's option. But the desire for home ownership, the desire for someone to be in a bigger house, desire for people to move out of a rental situation and perhaps be the first in their generation to own a home, that has always been a fundamental American dream. For every population, every immigrant population, I happen to be Irish and Scottish, that's what they dreamed about when they came to America. It's what Germans, French, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, you know, people, Asian from all around the world, Eastern Bloc countries, it's what they dream about. They come to America, they want to get a decent job, they want to have a home, and they don't want anybody to kick them out of it. It's never been different in our history. That's always been the case. But there was a fundamental change in our financial services sector that really is the reason we're in this crisis, this economic crisis, and the reason we're seeing, and we'll see in total, probably before we're done, between 15 to 16 million foreclosure filings in this country. And by the way, a few hundred thousand people, even a million people going into foreclosure, you can kind of blame and say, well, they should have known better. But 15, 16 million American families can't all be wrong. They can't all be greedy and they can't all be stupid. So, but it relates to the fundamental change that occurred. This is what's different in our history. In the history of finance in America, and particularly mortgage finance, there was always a fundamental principle. And it seems silly to say, but the principle is this. You don't make loans to people who can't afford it. What a novel idea. They abandoned that idea when banks no longer had to keep these loans in portfolio, when Wall Street told them, you make any loans. And Wall Street literally told them, the investment bank said, don't worry about documentation, don't worry about income, loan-to-value ratios. Get anybody to sign on these mortgages. Well, you will get your fee, and, of course, the investment bankers would get their fee, a much bigger fee. And the losers were going to be these investors who were looking at these things getting AAA rated ratings. 80% of all the high-cost loans got AAA ratings. Looking at them thinking, what a great investment. Meanwhile, the consumer up front, who normally would go into this institution and yes, they want to buy a house, or yes, they want a bigger house that they can afford. Normally, the fiduciarily responsible agent in that conversation, the banker or the broker, would say, I'm sorry, we just can't make the numbers work here. It doesn't make any sense. I don't think, and it's my job to make this assessment, I don't think you can really afford this at this point. Come back in a year, come back in 2 years. Instead, we not only had that person saying, no problem, sign here. They would coach them into saying they made more money. Don't you have a relative who contributes $100 a month to you? I don't need documentation on it. Or why do you want this little house? I can get you this big house. The very same broker who, you know, the bigger the house, the bigger the mortgage, the bigger the fee they got. So, and if you talk them into these high-cost loans, like interest only or option arms or arms that reset in a year and the interest rates rose appreciably, you actually get a bonus as a broker or a lender for that, called the yield spread premium. I mean, you know all this stuff. You've been talking to a lot of people. But what changed in our system of mortgage finance was one fundamental thing. The person who sat across the desk from the consumer no longer had a stake in ensuring that these loans were responsible. In fact, they had a financial interest in pushing this person to sign regardless of what their ability to pay, because they made their money.
Do you have a sense of when this changed?
Yes. It changed in 2001, 2000.
Yeah, I mean, you know, late 90s we started hearing stories, and yeah, it really did take off the first few years of the 21st century, you know.
Of the of
03 to 07 were the big years, but it was wrapping up 01, 02. Mm-hmm. You know, and John's right. We were testifying in Congress 2000, 2001. Yeah. Bad. This stuff was bad. You know, regulators sending letters.
We were like a, NCRC was like a you know, like a small person standing in front of a high speed train, shouting at the top of their lungs, you're going off a cliff. This is unsustainable. The train has no brakes, and the train is going to bring a lot of people down with it. And it just ran us over. Even now, the solution to this financial crisis, we proposed and had under Paulson. We went to Paulson, Secretary Paulson, and we went to Secretary Geithner. And we proposed something back in February of 07. It was eight.
Early 2008.
Yeah. February 8th. I think we actually met with Treasury in March of 2008. We said to them, look, you can't have this voluntary compliance program. You can't ask the very people who participated in the process of greasing the skids to allow all these loans to occur, these unsustainable, irresponsible lending activities. You can't ask those very same people to voluntarily agree with you to fix it. Some of them might, and some will do some, but the truth is you've got to step in there and and at least through a reverse auction on Wall Street, go and purchase the loans. Buy these securities. And you'll be able to buy them at a severe discount because the economy's collapsed. These securities are probably worth 70 cents on the dollar, if that. But the government will own these, and now you can, because you've had such a steep discount, you can turn around and have these things refinanced by the private sector without government guarantees in many instances. Most of the people were working, and we didn't have the unemployment rates we have now. But if you don't do that, if you wait for just the voluntary stuff, you're not going to have any success. Over and every month and every day in the press, and we talk about this. And it reminds me of being on that track, warning the Congress and warning the bank regulatory agencies and anybody who would listen that making these loans, these unsustainable predatory loans, was going to hurt not only the people involved, but hurt all of us. I have the same feeling now. And unfortunately, that train has also run us over.
What was the objection at the time?
Tell me what the objection is now.
But then, explain.
The market. Well, Paulson was the market will self-correct.
Okay.
Right. So I have a bridge in Brooklyn that you may be interested in purchasing. Mm-hmm. And with the Obama administration, it's like, it's very complicated and difficult to do. It's so difficult to do that you have people like Lou Ranieri through, not Fortis, but it's Simkus or Cyrus, or you guys can look it up for me if you would, actually doing precisely this. He's now buying these securities at a severe discount, I think 6 cents, 60 cents on the dollar. So right away he's getting these securities, right? It's 40% of the mortgage amount is gone. When I say gone, the investor lost. That's what happens. You invest, you sometimes lose. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. Now, they have a beef with the investment banks and the rating agency, whatever. They should bring that beef to them. But that's the solution to dealing with these foreclosures and dealing with it in a massive way. And so here you now, after proposing this for 3 years, day in and day out, sending them, at first we proposed a program where they do reverse auctions, where they just bid on it. So we've now eliminated that and said just don't do a reverse auction, simply go in and purchase these loans. Auction is still available, but mandate that this happen. Whether you have to pass a law or whatever it is, go in and take these things off the shelf, because waiting for these things as they rot on the vine and lose value and more people go into foreclosure is absolutely not the way to handle this crisis. So the Obama administration, they stuck with HAMP, and sometimes I don't know. I like a number of people in Treasury in the White House. I respect them, and they're very bright people. But what do you call a person that keeps banging their head against the wall, waiting for the wall to fall over, and it never does?
Well, this week they had to come forward and basically admit publicly that it was not working.
Of course.
But the statistics show it was not working.
No.
A week before the election.
Well, 400,000 permanent modifications out of 7 million loans, foreclosure filings? Let's see. 400,000 out of 7 million, well, 10%, if they just got 1 out of 10, it would have been 700,000. So it's probably like 6%. If we took a test in high school or college and we only got 6 out of 100 right, that'd be pretty bad. So, yeah, I mean, so they had a couple
of my first physics test in college, exactly.
I know physics is tough, isn't it? For me, it was, never mind. This is on the record.
Is there a new conversation now?
No,
there isn't. It's going to happen after the election?
There isn't. The new conversation is this. Well, we may not have been as successful as we wanted to under this program, but we've inspired all the banks to modify. And the problem is, really? So where's the data on all these modifications?
Isn't the data going the other way? The banks are saying no?
Yeah. Except the banks are saying now, in support of the administration, no, we've done another $3 million on top of what they've done. What do you mean in modifications? Well, we come to find out that modifications to them is an extremely broad definition. Uh-huh. So people's monthly payments may even go up.
Uh-huh.
And that's a modification.
Okay.
People get penalized and whatever, and it gets put on the back end. They spread it out over 40 years. In other words, is it really a sustainable loan? Are we looking at another 6 months down the road, they're in foreclosure again? Because they really, it's not a sustainable loan. It doesn't match their ability to pay. If you know, and they're saying, oh, the processes for doing it with government is so convoluted, we're just doing it on our own. Really? That's the reason? Okay. Okay, I believe you. You're an honest person, I'm sure. But why are we still seeing so many millions of people who have, and our counselors, the groups, we have 600 organizations that are members of NCRC, many of whom we fund to do counseling, and we do it, we do counseling ourselves. We have a whole floor of people who counsel people in foreclosure. So we deal in the front lines of this problem. And we have I don't know where all these modifications are occurring, because we're dealing with people who just have been frustrated over and over and over again, who do everything right, get all the paperwork in, apply for a modification, get put off, and in the end there's a foreclosure filing. And the story from our members who are counseling people on the front lines of this, the story from legal services attorneys, from mediators, it's the same story over and over again. I don't know where all these modifications are occurring, but we're just not seeing that on the front
line. Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
So there's been some suggestion to folks at the FCRC that actually individuals who are trying to do the right thing, borrowers, maybe in advance of getting further into trouble, they've missed a payment or whatever.
Yeah.
Or even in advance of that, they know they're going to be in trouble. That calling up and saying that they would like to pursue a modification actually puts a big target on them, and that they are then encouraged by the banks to not pay, and then the foreclosure actually does happen. Have you heard of instances?
We have heard of that, and I have to say, you know, someone might say, well, that's kind of cynical. You don't need any cynicism for this. There's so much reality out there of people who have played by the rules, who have applied and still haven't gone through modification, and still haven't been able to be helped to avoid the foreclosure process, that, you know, we don't even have to go there, is what I'm saying, Alexis, that it's just the mass of people who are trying to go through the modification program, whether there's a signal at the beginning when they run into the initial problem, you know, maybe there's a medical bill that puts them behind and they alert the, and whether that creates a target on their back. That may or may not be true. I don't know. I'm not inside these agencies, and I haven't done any research on that. But what we have seen and done over the last, how many years, Josh, with the counseling?
Counseling.
3 years.
Well, with HAP, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the counseling program was before HAP, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we were doing housing counseling before that, but now it's morphed into foreclosure counseling.
Sure. Right.
But that's been at least the last 3 years, and or most of the last 3 years, and, you know, there's just one consistent story of people who are just not being helped. I mean, it's rare that we finally, you know, I mean, we're happy that we're able to help tens of thousands of people, but in the process of that, hundreds of thousands, through our counseling agencies and through our members and through our own work, are falling through the cracks and not being helped.
How much of this is, let me put it this way, early on in the crisis, a lot of the trouble in modifications in HAMP and other places is being attributed to the presence of a second lien somewhere else owned by potentially the servicer.
Yeah.
Do you still run into that problem? Or
listen, I think the seconds, the holders of the seconds, which are predominantly the big banks, should be ashamed of themselves, because that is indeed one of the excuses constantly used. Whether they tell that to the homeowner or tell that to the counselor is another matter. But we know from conversations with enough services and enough agencies who are in the middle of the process of attempting to modify these loans that's a big problem and continues to be a big problem. And I have to say that There's an easy solution to that, and I proposed this to the White House a few weeks ago and to Dave Stevens at FHA. So, you know, and just so to be clear, so here's somebody who has a second lien, which by definition is in a second position interest to the first lien holder. But the second position person doesn't want to modify their loan while the first lien holder has to reduce their loan to make it work. Well, that doesn't seem fair in terms of the risk you took, the profitability you made as a second lien holder. And in terms of the way the financial system works, it's not fair. It's not fair to the first lien holder. They've got a point. Now, some people might say, well, the heck with the second. Well, sometimes the second is even bigger than the first lien, you know, because it was a refinancing that became second. The first lien wasn't totally paid off, or because it was a huge home equity line of credit, or, you know, there's all sorts of things that can make that second mortgage not insignificant. So here's what I think should occur is, if the first lien holder is willing to modify the loan so that it matches the borrower's ability to pay, which is what should have happened in the first place. Had they done that, we wouldn't have this problem. Okay. And maybe some of these lenders are saying, well, I didn't make this original loan. Tough. You bought it. You service it. You're responsible for it. That's what happens when Bank of America buys Countrywide, or Chase acquires AmeriQuest, or a city acquires AmeriQuest, or Wells acquired World Savings and Wachovia. You're inheriting their, not just their goodwill, but their bad will and the responsibilities associated with that. So, you know, but let's say you have the first lien holder really willing to say, look, I'm going to reduce this principal and interest to match this borrower's ability to pay. But I got someone with a, and I'm going to reduce it. It's going to, I'm not only going to reduce the interest to prime rate, or maybe a point below prime, I'm going to reduce principal by 10%. But the guy behind me, in a second position, doesn't want to reduce anything. And he ought to reduce it also to prime and to 10%. So there's two ways of going about this. There is, you foreclose on paper, and then you resell the property to the existing homeowner. And that eliminates the second. Now the second person loses everything, right? Because you're in a second position. If you foreclose and the property is sold, you're in the second position. That's a little iffy because it's a sale process. The second can get engaged. They can affect the price. There's all sorts of things that can happen there that may not work out in the interest of the homeowners. But there is something the government could do. And this is what I told the White House and FHA people. So you say to the second lien holders, if you're not willing to act as fairly as the first lien holder to resolve this problem and allow working families to continue to be in their home and to be responsible mortgage payers, don't come to the FHA for any securitizations or to Fannie or Freddie. Our window will be shut to you. You might even get Ben Bernanke to go along with shutting the Fed window, the access window, because most of these are banks, right? Big banks. And they need access to the Fed window. So, you don't want to cooperate? Don't expect us to loan you money. Don't expect TOP. Don't expect us to securitize anything you bring us. They would sit up, fly right, play ball, quick and in a hurry. It's not just the bully pulpit, right? You've got to use the resources of the government and the power of the government to ensure that people, particularly those who have been part of the problem, the banks, work with the government and the homeowner, the servicer, and different lien holders to be part of the solution.
What was the reaction you got?
I actually got a, and both Dave Stevens wrote that down and the people at the White House wrote it down, so maybe it's being tossed around in there. But it'll come out as, you know, a brilliant idea on their part, but I don't care how it comes out, as long as it comes out. Because that's what they need to do. They need to play hardball with these people.
Well, it's funny, too, because, you know, NCRC and John have been promoting this approach for years, and then you picked up the New York Times a few months ago, and Hubbard was, what, Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, and basically proposing the same thing in the New York Times op-ed. And then just this week...
On what?
The Help Now approach.
Oh, Help Now. Yeah. You were talking about the... Close the Fed window
and
FHA. Help now.
And then, you know, just this week, the housing conference, I guess that the FDIC sponsored, you had the economist from the Boston Fed, Paul Whelan, I believe, basically said there's two ways to deal with this. Either the taxpayers are going to pay the banks to modify the loans, or the banks are going to take a hit. You know, which interest in society, which party in society is going to take a hit. You know, we know how to do it. It's just a question of who's going to who's going to do it.
And investors are going to take a hit.
Right, well, that too. But, you know, so...
And you know, so hopefully investors will be smarter in the future about who they do business
with. We're getting to the Rubicon, and we have to cross the Rubicon, you know, and somebody's going to have to... If we're going to resolve this crisis, or it's going to go on for years.
So going back to how we got here, you'd mentioned earlier two things I think are interesting. I'd like you to expand on a little, if you could. One is, you mentioned that the process for a home buyer walking into the offices or somehow getting in touch with a high-cost lender is not the same as what most Americans experience buying their prime loan.
Right. And that's something...
Can you expand on that? What is that process like?
Let me emphasize, most Americans don't understand that, too, because, you know, it's unfortunate. The perception that most people have when they see somebody who's in trouble with a mortgage is... You know, how did they ever get into that? I didn't. I've been a homeowner. I've bought two homes. I never had that problem. You know, I mean, they're looking at themselves and they're saying, "Gee, how could they have taken that loan? Shouldn't they have been smarter?" And there might be a grain of truth in that about, you know, they should have been smarter. But most people don't realize the experience of most people who ended up in foreclosure because of they got a bad product. Unemployment. I'll address that later. Unemployment is a whole other set of problems, and that's now overtaken the bad product as the number one reason for foreclosures, but it's not disconnected to the foreclosures. I'll talk about that later. But this notion of most people not understanding your experience in walking into a mortgage company or a bank is not the same experience as the people who in 2000, 2001 to 2008 walked into offices with people sitting behind the desk whose only goal was to have you sign a piece of paper that committed you to a mortgage, because that's how they made their money, and they had no responsibility to you, even though most people walking into offices with lenders and brokers think they're actually working for them. You, the borrower, think they're actually working for you. They weren't, and they don't. And they had no responsibility to even the securitizer, or in particular to the investor who was investing in these products, to ensure that these were quality, ethical, sustainable mortgages. None. Because as long as that borrower, depending on the contract, paid their mortgage for a month or anywhere from a month to 3 months, they got their $3,000, $4,000 fee. So this giant Ponzi scheme, orchestrated on the front end and the back, front end by lenders and brokers, and on the, on the back end by lenders and brokers. Well, I don't know which end is which, but on both ends were the investment banks and securitizers, and on the other end, bankers and brokers. And the bankers and brokers would get the appraisers in the room and say to them, "Look, this homeowner wants to sell their property. They want like $500,000 for this house that they paid $300,000 for 4 years ago. I need you to appraise this thing. Don't lowball me. Remember, you get your fee from me, and if you lowball me too much, I'll hire another appraiser." I mean, I'm breaking it down to its basic components, but I want to tell you, that's what happened 95% of the time. It was either that or the bank actually owned and managed the appraisal company. So Countrywide, for example, had its own appraisal company, even though FIREA said there has to be an arm's length independence between the appraisers and the mortgage lender. Well, how do you have arm's length if you all report to the same super boss? So, and we saw letters of big banks. We have copies of letters where we blanked out names of everything but the bank, but basically the letters say, it's a letter from the mortgage of the part of the bank to the appraisal part of the bank saying, "You're killing us. You got to stop lowballing these appraisals. Or you got to increase the appraisal amounts. Because we're losing loans because you're putting in these true values." You know, we have one of those letters somewhere, don't we?
You know, David.
Yeah.
I'm the credit rating agency too.
Yeah. So wait a minute. I'm going to get to that.
If you're willing to share the letters with the commission, that would be great. If you could send over.
Let me think about that. It actually names a lender, and it's on their stationery. and it's from their head of their mortgage division to their appraisal division.
Was it Countrywide?
Nope. It wasn't Countrywide. It was a big bank. So, so they got the appraiser to go along so that any price they wanted, so if a borrower walked in there, they could say to the borrower, yeah, the house was only $300,000 a few years ago, but look at this appraisal. This thing is worth $500,000 now. And I can put you in this home. You don't want that small home. How many times in counseling we've heard the experiences of people going in for one loan and walking out with another and a different, going into a broker for one house and walking out with a bigger, more expensive house. I can't tell you how many times that happened. Again, you can blame the borrower and say, oh, they should have known better. But people got to understand, they weren't dealing with the same ethical standards and lenders that most people dealt with. They were dealing with crooks. The free market, free to abuse, free to cajole, free to cheat, free to steal, free to lie to, free to practice predatory lending. That's what they were dealing with. Most people don't understand that because most people's experience, my own, you know, I've bought houses, my wife and I. We never ran into any of these. And I remember when this stuff was going on, I remember being at the closing and saying to the lender, now, are there any yield spread premiums, or are there any balloon payments of this? Are there any, you know, and I kept asking these questions, and they were laughing. No, there's none of that. There's none of that. They would laugh. But the only reason I knew to ask those questions was because of the work that I do. But there are a lot of people in there who would say, well, geez, I don't know if I could afford this loan. I mean, this is a lot of monthly payments, and the brokers and lenders, and we've heard this 10,000 times from our members, from our own counseling. It's always the same story. Oh, no, you can afford this. Look, your property value is going to go up. If you run into trouble, you can always refinance. Interest rates are going down. So when the interest rates go down more, you just refinance and you can afford it. And if worse comes to worse, your house is worth more than what you're buying it today, so you sell it and you walk away with $100,000. It was a con job overlaid against the Ponzi screen with the rule of law thrown out the window. You know, I love testifying, especially in front of Jeb Hensarling and these Republicans, you know, because their patron saint is Adam Smith. Little did they know, some of them know, but Adam Smith actually had a very great social consciousness. But he was the one, of course, the one who was the Pied Piper of the free market. You know, that's their saint. But I finally took the time to actually look up, you know, Adam Smith and his comments about the free market, which was his most famous one is the most important ingredient in a democracy is a free market. But the part they leave out when they quote that is what he said immediately after that in the next sentence. Coupled with a rule of law, which ensures fairness and integrity. I'm not sure I get the exact words right, but he uses the term rule of law to ensure that the industry acts ethical. That's what was thrown out the window, the rule of law, in this whole period. And the idea that what we need now is less laws, less regulation, and let the free market prevail tells me either people are highly influenced on who contributes to their campaign so they can keep their job as congresspeople, or they're stupid. Because there's no other explanation to me of what's going on here. Because anybody who's lived through this period saw it very clearly what was going on here. The independent mortgage companies, which were less regulated by the banks, less regulated by anybody, almost no accountability whatsoever, were free to do whatever they wanted without any repercussion. And they managed to work themselves into oblivion, but in the process, injuring tens of millions of Americans, not just those who lost their jobs, but to all the millions of Americans who lost value in their homes because of this period of predatory abusive lending. And to people who have lost jobs because, you know, when you have vacancy rates which amount to 12 months of vacancies, that'll take 12 months to fill those homes before, you know, we need more homes. Well, home builders are not going to be building. That's what's happened to the home building industry. It's shrunk by 50%. Who's going to build new homes when you've got vacant houses everywhere for sale? So all those carpenters, plumbers, electricians, roofers, sheet metal workers, masons, painters, they're out of work. All those people who provide raw materials for the home building industry are out of work. All the appliances and the associated industries to home building, like rugs and cabinets and appliances like washer dryers and so on that come standard in most houses, well, they're laying off people as well. So this brought down our economy and it brought with it a lot of people. And if we don't appreciate that, this all occurred because people were free to practice greed and abuse without anybody stepping in, even those who knew. Because people can't say, the regulatory agencies cannot say they didn't hear, that they weren't warned, that we and others didn't tell them. We did. They just chose to believe, as Hank Paulson did, and as Alan Greenspan did, that the free market would never do anything to abuse itself, that it would correct itself when it saw abuses. We now know that that's not true. The abuse continued until there was a collapse of monumental proportions to where there was no further any market for this kind of activity. The market died. And still to this day, private label securities, how are we ever going to jumpstart Wall Street and our private label securities? You know, people like Hensley and others talk about getting rid of Fannie and Freddie and FHA. But you get rid of them, you get rid of home sales in America, because those are the securitizers right now in America. Private label is non-existent. Why? Because all those people who invested billions of their pension funds, hundreds of millions of pension funds, not just from America, but from governments around the world and pension funds around the world, don't trust us. And they shouldn't. If I'm the French Dental Association and they put $10 million into a mortgage-backed security in America and I find out that the investment bankers knew that these are unsustainable and even encouraged unsustainable loans, that they paid off the rating agencies to give them AAA ratings, and that the lenders and brokers up front got their fee and didn't care whether these things were sustainable, and that millions of people were put into loans that they shouldn't have and couldn't afford, and they used my money to do it, why would I ever invest in America again? The biggest problem right now, and the thing that's, I think, a hurdle to the Obama administration and future administrations, is how are we ever going to get them back? Maybe Dodd-Frank will help, because there's new rules. Maybe the CFPB will send out a message, this can't happen again. But it's a trust issue. People don't believe in our free market.
John, we're trying to think through all the causes of the crisis. And you were just talking about regulatory agencies. Is there any doubt in your mind that the FCIC should talk about the regulatory agencies as causal, directly causal, not complicating the situation but causing the crisis?
Directly causing as opposed to directly not causing it to cease. If someone sees a small fire break out in a house and they have the ability to extinguish that immediately, and instead they stand there and watch till it gets out of hand and then they can't do anything about it, would you say that person is responsible for the fire, for the house burning down? I would. I think we have a responsibility to each other, but also the regulatory agencies have a responsibility to ensure safety and soundness in our financial institutions, integrity in our financial services system, and they have the responsibility under CRA, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Housing Act, TLR, RESPR, and several other pieces of legislation to ensure that consumers are not abused. If you fail to enforce that and fail to live up to that responsibility, you absolutely are cause to the problem. The point of having those responsibilities is to prevent problems from occurring, to prevent abuse, to prevent malfeasance, to prevent unsafe and unsound lending practices. If you don't exercise that authority, you absolutely are the cause. You may not be the originator or the progenitor of the idea, but if you're the sheriff and you don't step in to prevent an abusive system from taking hold and taking off, you are absolutely responsible. And it appalls me that just like Wall Street, we not only, you know, aside from some media pundits and people like us criticizing them, they've pretty much gotten not only off scot-free, with the exception of Lehman Brothers, who must not have had enough friends in the Bush White House. We've actually bailed them out. That's the part that makes me pull out my hair, is we actually stepped up and made sure that they didn't fail, which is probably the right thing to do, because we would have seen an economic collapse that would have been a depression rather than a recession. I believe that. I buy that. Whether that's accurate, who knows? You know, but I believe it. But isn't it high time we held Wall Street accountable to say, you guys got to work with us. It's no longer voluntary. It's no longer optional. You've got to work with us to straighten out as many of these foreclosures as possible. You, the regulatory agencies, have an affirmative obligation now because of your negligence and your irresponsibility and your complete capitulation from enforcement and oversight and protecting consumers that you exercised in this period of time to make sure that this stuff happens. That's why Bernanke should be up there saying, I'm closing the Fed window to anybody who does not participate in HAMP or participate in a meaningful, sustainable modification program. He can do that. There's other things he can do. I mean, these banks fear the Fed more than they fear Obama or Bush.
Do you think Bernanke is playing it straight when he says that he did not understand the securitization products and the direction that they had gone, that he did not really comprehend that?
Is he playing it straight? I think Greenspan was playing it straight. I think people arrive with the ideology, and the facts and the information that arrives to them gets processed through that ideology and their belief as to how things work. You know, Greenspan, and to his credit, admitted, I never thought the market would act this way because it was so injurious to itself. I thought it would fix itself. I didn't think it would work against its self-interest. That's his belief. At least he was honest about it. However naive that might seem, you know, in hindsight. I think Bernanke probably believes that his mindset told him that this isn't the way it worked. But now he knows. There's crooks up there. There's greedy people who will abuse people to the point of disrupting their lives in a catastrophic way and even contribute to the downfall of the American economy in exchange for earning tens of millions of dollars personally. That's, you know, that's unfortunately, you know, our history, the history of mankind is full of people who are like that, who do anything at all costs to enrich themselves, even if it means hurting other people. So we know this now.
So you mentioned early on the role of the brokers, or the on-the-street lenders, the appraisal. You know, we discussed the issue of, you know, bad incentives for the appraisers and the securitizers. And you even mentioned, I think, the rating agencies being bought off. So there's one other party in this chain, which is, you know, the ultimate investor. Because one of the arguments, if I were to put on the Greenspan or the Bernanke hat, one of the arguments back then was, why would I buy this stuff? The NCRC is screaming that these are predatory loans. They're going to go bad. Eventually somebody's willing to buy that AAA paper or even other parts of that.
Well, the medium is the message, right? Had Bernanke or Greenspan said, look, this is highly risky stuff. You should know that these securities, the underpinning of these securities is based on multi-layers of risk. And regardless of the AAA rating, you should know that these are subprime high-cost loans that are not the same as prime loans. I mean, had he said that, even as mild as that, perhaps some investors could have been alerted. But when you see a Moody's, a Fitch, or an S&P slap a AAA rating on a security, at least what that said to me, and I suspect a lot of investors, and of course then you have the investment bank who's, you know, very bright, you know, Harvard Business School, Yale Business School, all the Ivy Leagues, all the major business schools, people with their degrees hanging on the wall, convincing investors to put tens of millions of dollars. It's not a Harvard degree. It's a Northeastern. It's a working class school.
It's a very notable Boston institution.
Yeah, it is. So you have these people convinced because this person looks very successful and very polished that they're going to take care of your money and they're going to invest in a way that's going to really take care of you. But they don't know that these very same investment banks are taking these piles of securities and walking into Fitch, Moody's, and S&P and saying, okay, now, I got a bunch of loans here. I need AAAs on this stuff. I got my checkbook right here in my pocket. Now, Fitch, if you're not willing to give me the ratings I need, I'm taking my business out of here. But if you're willing to give me AAA ratings, I'll sign the check today. I'll pay your salary and your bonus and everybody else in this agency. Now, the conversation wasn't that crass. It didn't need to be, obviously. But that's the way the system worked. And still does. I went to S&P. Here's something for you. And we paid him a visit because we were wondering back in, was it, do you remember, Josh, when that was, 2001?
I don't remember this story.
2002. Okay, so we went to New York. David might remember. And we went to them, and because we were very curious, why would they be slapping AAA rated ratings on these very high-risk mortgages and packages of mortgages? And what were they thinking when they looked at these loans in terms of their sustainability? So we went, and I expected, you know, the meeting was set up, that I was going to see some vice president of security, or mortgage securities or something. And I walk into the room, and there's the general counsel for S&P. There's an executive vice president there, as well as the VP that we expected, and a few other people. And I'm thinking, wow. And, of course, hindsight is always 20/20, but most of the time it doesn't seem to be for a lot of people who blame Fannie and Freddie and CRA instead of the free market. But their hindsight seems to be 10/12. I don't know what that is. But here I am sitting in front of these S&P people, and we're saying to them, how do you determine, you know, what, how to rate, how do you determine whether a loan is, how does the bank communicate to you how risky a loan is? So they hand us a piece of paper, and it shows, well, they check off all these things. You know, they depending on the loan, they check these things off. And on this sheet of paper with S&P is, you know, fixed rate, adjustable rate mortgage, interest only, low documentation, no documentation. They've codified all these predatory practices in their forms. So through that, what they're doing is saying, it's okay, you know, we'll, you know, just check the box where they apply. So then we said, well, how do you know what you're getting? I mean, the check boxes with all these securities, and there's, you know, thousands of them in this package. I mean, how do you know that it's accurate? I mean, what is the due diligence that you do to make sure that what you're being told and the product that you're rating is in fact one and the same? That what is the due diligence? And I'll never forget what that person said to me as long as I live. Oh, well, we're not a due diligence agency. And I sat there and I said to myself, wow, there goes my image of a whole floor of this S&P building being full of nothing but actuarials who are crunching numbers on the underwriting characteristics and the risk associated with these things. That just went out the window. And then I said to him, don't you think that when people come and invest millions of dollars in the security and they see a AAA rating from your agency or from Moody's or Fitch, that they're thinking that, in fact, you're certifying that this is the best investment because you've actually done due diligence? They may be doing that, but that's not what we do, and we don't tell them we do that. I said, wow. Someone needs to tell the investing public, you know.
Do you have any memory of who it was you talked to since?
No, but we could document that. I mean, because it was 5-6 years ago, and I just remember coming out of the building.
Because that's really early, actually.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were in shock of that experience. I mean, imagine a rating agency saying they don't do due diligence,
when
and that's
heard
not
that,
what
did you do? Did you start writing about it?
Yes, we brought it to people's attention. I've told this story 1,000 times. I'm surprised you haven't heard that. You know, I've told it on television. I've told newspapers. But the problem is, it kills me. The newspapers don't quote that stuff. And to me, that was one of the most significant learnings and experiences I had in this process, is that the very agency that most people are investing in because it's like the good housekeeping seal of approval is saying, no, we don't really do any due diligence on this. And why should they? Because what if they found out that it was more risky? Are they going to turn down the guy who's paying their salary? It's so that system is so inherently and intuitively against the interest of the general public. The system of having a rating agency paid by the person who needs the rating for their product. There's just too much room for that conflict to result in malfeasant practice. And that's exactly what we experienced in this whole period of time. And yet, what does Dodd-Frank do about this? Do you remember?
Well, remember Franken's amendment, they're going to do a study.
Yeah,
and then
they're
the study's going to recommend whether it's going to be the Franken approach or some other approach to remedy this.
Right. So, did I not answer your...
You did.
Okay.
I want to... You mentioned in your last answer, and I think...
Have everything I'm saying you've heard already?
Some, but it's good to hear. We are interviewing a broad range of people. Hundreds, actually. I think we're up to 600 people or more to understand all facets of the crisis. So this particular discussion of the rating agencies, for example, as early as you mentioned in the conversation, I think is probably one of those.
Is probably what?
Early.
That's probably earlier than others.
Yeah.
That is, if you have any documentation about that,
let's see what we can find when that meeting is.
That would be very useful.
Because I'm sure we made note of who we were meeting with. And
if you have an old calendar.
Yeah, that's what we'll look up.
I don't know if you keep that. That's probably hard to...
Well, you know, everything's online, but we have a server that supposedly captures everything. I don't know where it goes. But we'll see.
So early on, you'd also mentioned that the first wave of foreclosures were the result of the aggressive products, the aggressive tactics of the...
Yeah.
Would eventually be tied to the private label securitization, and that now it's more a story of unemployment and the economic collapse.
Right.
And you alluded, you'd get back to explaining that connection between the two, that they're not unrelated.
Well, I got into it briefly, and that is the millions of foreclosures that we experienced because people were simply in loans that were inappropriate, that didn't match their ability to pay. And by the way, Dodd-Frank actually legislates now that lenders can only make loans to people who can substantiate their ability to pay, and not just in the first year, but in multiple years going out. The fact that we actually had to legislate that, I was telling that story to some folks in Paris not too long ago, no, in Hamburg. I said, you know, the Frank Dodd bill passed yesterday, or it's about to pass, and one of the things that's going to be in there, a mainstay, is that we're going to make it illegal for lenders to loan money to people who can't afford to pay the loan back. And there was this uproar of laughter in the audience. But it's sad laughter for me, you know.
I say that whenever I speak.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. That we had to do that. It really bespeaks just what happened to the industry, that we actually have to legislate that. The first round of loans that were made in the 2000, 2001 to 2004, which began to come home the roost in terms of their being problematic in 2005 and 6 and in a big way in 7, were loans that where the interest rates reset over a period of a year or 2 years, where the interest-only option morphed into now you have to start paying principal, where clearly people who were put on a raft in the middle of the ocean could no longer sustain themselves and had no place, no buoys or anything to grab onto. That began to sink hundreds of thousands of homes throughout the country. And of course, what was it, in July of 07, when it happened in such a massive amount that it collapsed the economy. You could point to those loans with a very small exception to being primarily due to the actual product and the lack of quality of that product, the predatory nature and abusive nature of those products. Around 2000 and early 2009, I would say we shifted from that being the primary reason for foreclosures to unemployment being the biggest contributor. And the unemployment occurred when the economy collapsed, driven by these foreclosures. And obviously, some other pent-up problems that we had in the economy that when the bubble burst, they flooded out with them, not the least of which is unsustainable commercial loans. But as I said, there is no bigger job producer in this country than home building, because there are so many industries that are associated with it. And when you collapse the home building industry, when you see major firms lay off 50% of the people and many other firms, smaller ones, just completely go out of the business, and those owners go back to being carpenters doing piecemeal jobs or contractors doing piecemeal jobs, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of people in the building trades who simply no longer have any work.
Nationwide.
And then they start to lose their home. All these people lose their home, the government revenue, particularly cities and towns that are dependent upon real estate tax revenue for their infrastructure, for their police and fire and hospitals and schools, have less income. Not only the income that's lost when there's a foreclosure and no one's paying real estate taxes, but the devaluation of properties across the neighborhood and indeed across the community because of these foreclosures are mounting up and reducing property values. The cities and towns have less revenue. I don't know what they would have done without this the Obama's
stimulus,
the Recovery Act
funds. I really don't know what they would have done. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of their roads and bridges and many other things that happens in local cities and towns. Everywhere I go, I see the signs of where it was invested. People wonder what happened to it. Well, shit, open your eyes, take a look. What the hell do you think happened to it? You know, and but obviously that costs a lot of people jobs because schools are laying off people. You know, in my state, we lost 1,000 policemen in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. 1,000 that were slated to be hired. Well, several hundred were slated to be hired. Not only did we not get that, we lost people. The net result was we lost 1,000 police officers. And you know, Governor Patrick is being criticized for it. Well, how do you hire 1,000 more policemen if you don't have money to do it, when your state is already in deficit? Same story everywhere.
As we sit here today, do you have a good estimate, since you're so experienced in this, how long it's going to take for the housing market to stabilize?
That's a very broad question, because I'm not sure what you mean by stabilization. Mm-hmm. Property values to stabilize, then we hit bottom? We have...
The overhang of...
Understood. We have more foreclosures drive down property values. That's just a fact. Okay. So I wish one of these brilliant econometricians in Treasury or in the White House would explain to me why fast-tracking and allowing for another 3 or 4 million foreclosures is going to somehow help the economy. Mm-hmm. We know what already 3.5 million foreclosures have done to our economy.
Do you think they bought into this idea that we need to, quote unquote, flush them out?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think.
So they
but that's a bit of, you know, I have to say, that's a bit of, like, let's go back to the house analogy with the fire. Gee, the house is on fire. Well, maybe we should try and put out the fire. Let's get a hose. So they get a garden hose. The garden hose doesn't work. And NCRC is over here saying, no, 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 you need a real serious hose, and you need to mandate that all the water be directed to put that fire out now. And they don't do that. And then, you know, they're still with the hose. Well, they get another garden hose, and they're trying, but the fire is really burning out of control. And so finally they step back and they say, you know what, let it burn. We'll just rebuild it, and, you know, we'll start over again. That's not good management in my book. Leadership and management is about managing through crises and having as little impact on the victims and on people who are going to be injured by whether it's this fire or this foreclosure fire. Mm-hmm. The idea of just throwing up your arms, and to me that's what it is, shit, nothing's working. Well, try a couple other things about things that have been suggested, like get the Fed involved, shut off access to these banks, force them to make these loans. Force them to participate. I mean, there are things that can be done, but instead it's like, yeah, let's just foreclose on all these people and we'll hit the bottom. Yeah, it'll get a lot worse, but is that management
and
leadership?
So going back to your example, if the nation is smoldering, mm-hmm. a lot of fires, how long, if they continue
yes.
policies as they are, and
right.
we see the statistics now and the trends,
right.
I mean, we're seeing what's happening to housing prices and
well, it depends.
Starts,
yeah.
how long?
Okay, so it depends on... See, because it isn't just how quickly they foreclose on what they got. And by the way, vacant and abandoned properties, they should foreclose and put them on the market and sell them. Okay, it's not going to help the home building industry because there's going to be more vacant housing for sale. But, you know, that makes a lot of sense, you know, rather than
right.
just sitting there not being income producing.
Right.
But it depends. The answer to that question depends on what you believe is waiting in the wings in the way of the foreclosure crisis. So, you can believe, let's take a market assessment, like... Amherst Securities. Their estimate is that there are 11 million more foreclosure filings that are going to occur. Or you can listen to Mark Zandi. Mark Zandi says somewhere between, 6-7 million more foreclosures. Whether you're talking about 7 million or 11 million, if half of those are foreclosed on, we'll have more foreclosures than we've already had through this debacle, through this economic recession. Than we've already experienced.
Well,
so you tell me, if you double the number of foreclosures that we've already had and put that many more people out of their homes and that many more people out of work, when do you think the recovery is going to occur?
Right. Right.
Not soon.
Right.
And certainly not by the next presidential election.
Am I correct that the statistic estimate for 2010 is 1 million? Is that right?
No. For 1 million foreclosures or 1 million...
In 2010.
Of filings or foreclosures?
Foreclosures.
1 million would be... what would you say, Josh? What would you say a million? Would you say 1 million in 2000? Foreclosures, not filings.
I think it would be higher than that.
Yeah.
You think it's higher?
Yeah. I mean, figure there's 300,000 foreclosure filings in a month yeah. on average.
So I guess that's realty track figures.
That's filings, though. You're talking about actual foreclosures.
Actual foreclosures.
Well, let me just say, once they get by this robo-signing and documentation problem, which for some lenders will take a little while, but not that much long. Bank of America, it only took 2 weeks. You know, they're obviously on a high-speed track, and I wonder if they've taken signals from the government or wherever it's come, but all of a sudden they are pushing a lot of foreclosures into the pipeline. So I think it's going to be appreciably more than 1 million.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're writing this section of the book, so we're trying to make it as up to date.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Other causes that we should be thinking about that we might not have asked you about?
Well, I want to emphasize the role that appraisers had. Appraisers at the front end of this drove up property values artificially. October research showed that 95% of the appraisers were influenced by the broker or the lender to alter their appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in Frank Dodd and Dodd-Frank? See who I deal with mostly.
It's not that appraises. Strong an appraiser.
Right. You know, we recommended some things which didn't catch in. But
it's just independence, you know, mechanism.
It's like we don't learn from these mistakes. I mean, the appraisers played a huge role in this whole thing.
Well, it's against the law, right? It is against the law.
Currently, and maybe a little strengthened in Dodd-Frank.
But it's an opinion, right, as to what you think.
No, in the past. It was against the law.
It's against the law for the broker or the lender to tell the appraiser what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the way this works, I mean, we've done a lot of work on this. No, we've done a lot of work on this, Alexis. We even have what's called the Center for Responsible Appraisals and Valuations. It's called CRAV. We created a website. We created an organization.
Right.
We made proposals to the administration, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, about what they need to do about appraisers. We work with appraisal companies. The appraisers, most of them were actually praying that we were successful.
Okay.
Because they knew that they were a part of this, but they also knew that the way it would work is if maybe it's a wink and a nod from the lender about whether the praise is accurate or whether you're happy, but the ultimate thing was the bank would no longer refer clients to you or call you for clients, or they'd cancel contracts. And we saw huge agencies that tried to have integrity disappear overnight because big banks would cancel the contracts and say, you know, you're not playing ball with us. And it wouldn't be that obvious because that is against the law.
Right.
But it's obvious it doesn't work. It has to be enforced, and that the law has to, there has to be a bright line, and there has to be a system that allows for mediated disputes so that appraiser can't feel totally at risk if they are pissing off the lender or disappointing the lender or the broker. So
that's what's not
in place.
The reason I was asking you about this is because there's a part of the book in which we're talking about enforcement and of, or investigation of fraud, enforcement, and the appraisal data has come to everyone's attention. Is there anything you want to add about where law enforcement was, how hard it was to pursue these, how time intensive it was, why they didn't?
Which law enforcement was responsible for going in to assess whether appraisers are, I mean, I remember sitting with Julie Williams and John Hawk and all the people at the OCC talking to them about the appraisal fraud and issues. And they were very interested, but they didn't do shit.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we've talked to so many deaf ears here, Republicans and Democrats, that, you know, it's just been the most frustrating experience. And I'm, you know, today you're just coming to me on a day when Jeff Ensslin is on the front page of American Banker saying corporate America good, government bad. And, you know, unfortunately, I think most people are buying that, because if you keep saying, you keep blaming somebody else for the problem, eventually people think they must have been the problem. I see people who think Fannie and Freddie caused this whole thing.
I have two examples of regulatory benign neglect. One example was actually an agency was putting gasoline in the fire, and that was the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. In 2004, they preempted state anti-predatory lending laws.
Oh, yeah.
And who was the lender who was asking them to do that? National City. What happened to National City?
Mm-hmm.
National City no longer exists.
Yeah.
It was really the lending of First Franklin.
We filed a lawsuit, just so you know, with the Attorney General of New York, Cuomo, in opposition to the OCC's determination that these were national banks and you didn't have a right to institute a state law that prohibited predatory lending. We challenged that in court with the Attorney General, and of course we lost. I mean,
the second one is, under the Homeownership Equity Protection Act, Regulation Z, the Federal Reserve had the authority to strengthen protections against unfair and deceptive lending. In 1994, Congress gave them that power.
Mm-hmm.
When did the Fed update its Regulation Z that implements HOPA? July 2008.
Mm-hmm.
When the fire was
in fully raging.
The fire was out of control.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the second. So those are two rather big examples, and there's a whole lot of other examples.
Right.
In addition to the belief
the FTC was responsible for the independent mortgage companies.
Right, but they never had the resources,
I remember, Josh, you might have been at that meeting when we were sitting with them talking about what they were doing to investigate these independent mortgage companies. And let's face it, that was the leader of the pack. You know, if this was a bunch of mad dogs just eating everything in their sight, meaning consumers and consumers' equity and down payments and investor investments, the lead dogs in that pack were the independent mortgage companies. And I'm just talking analogies today, and forgive me, I don't know how it's going to look in print. But the holder of the leash on those dogs was the FTC. And as Josh said, they didn't have the capacity. I remember them telling us that we have two people to do investigations. I remember them saying that. Into this kind of fraud and abuse.
They had a staff of two.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when that was? How early you spoke to the FTC about this?
Oh, that would be six years ago. And we brought to their attention the appraisal stuff. We brought to their attention, you know, the predatory lending, and, you know, we'd meet with them, and they'd all be very interested, and, you know, they had no capacity, and they weren't asking for it. You know, it wasn't like they were like, look, we need to expand these departments and we need more help and so on. They just let them do what the heck they wanted.
This sounds a lot like the Big Gap, because Reg Z, right, or any revisions to Reg Z are under the Fed's authority, both the 2001 and eventually 2008 revisions.
Yeah.
2001 was very minimal.
It was the dropping of the threshold and the single payment, the premium payments.
Yes, yeah. Single premium credit insurance. You had to wait 1 year before you could flip a loan. That was it.
Yeah.
But then the enforcement of Reg Z is quite diffused between the OTS for their banks, the OCC for their banks, the Fed for theirs, and then the FTC for...
HUD has some authority over it.
And HUD.
So you have six or seven agencies. I mean, the whole idea of the Consumer Protection Bureau is put it in one agency and you really give them power. If you have six or seven agencies, you know how long it takes them to do a rule, you know how long rulemaking takes. I mean, we've witnessed this, you know, in CRA and others. It just takes years. You have six agencies in the room, you'll have eight ideas, you know. And also, they don't want to do strong regulation because they compete against each other for segments of the financial industry to go under their supervision.
Yes.
Can I follow on this part? We've heard lots of anecdotal threads from very many people, including inside the government, about the turf issues, just exactly what you described, as being one of the enormous complications of talking to deaf ears. But then we've also heard from a variety of people.
Have they ever heard of the FFIEC? Isn't that the very purpose why that agency was created? So they could deal with issues that cross over into different agencies?
Just the inherent nature of government.
Right.
But then we've also heard about the very tremendous influence of the industry itself in town, the financial influence. Can you sort out this idea that inside government they were in competition among themselves so that they did themselves their own sort of harm, versus the outside pressures from the industry itself to influence Congress and the agencies and departments?
Well, you know, to quote a member of Congress, Dick Durbin, we have the best Congress that money can buy. That is the biggest challenge to our democracy today. And it manifests itself in everything that the government does, whether it's environment or whether it's transportation or education or financial services. And it's through this whole crisis, I mean, obviously leading up to it, the banks were very influential in making sure that we didn't pass any predatory lending bill other than what Bonnie managed to get done in the House. Mm-hmm. But nothing happened in the Senate, and they fought that tooth and nail and watered down what we got passed in the House. But they really worked against any type of laws, and we saw them all the time. We saw them. I remember going to a meeting. What was the meeting I went with Jesse Jackson when the Senate?
That was Gramm-Leach Bly in 1999.
Yeah. So 1999, Gramm-Leach Bly, they were...
closet.
Yeah, they were actually ending the firewall between other industries and banking.
Yeah, separation.
Yeah, what was the law?
Glass-Steagall.
And I remember going to that meeting. I remember I was at a thing with Jesse Jackson, and I said, Jesse, we need to go up to Reverend Jackson. We need to go up to the Congress right now as we're speaking. The House and Senate Banking Committees are meeting closed doors to determine the future of finance in America by changing some laws that really protected consumers. And our interest also was that they had some CRA stuff in there. They were going to, you know, allow insurance companies into the business without having them have any obligation to report data or any CRA-like obligation. And Phil Graham was pushing to make CRA more burdensome for banks by actually adding reporting requirements relative to the relationships with community groups. That was actually in the legislation. So we had all these interests, and we
CRA sunshine.
Yeah. So. I go up with the Reverend, and it was a surreal experience, because we're at the National Press Club, we get into a town car that the Reverend has. He drives up to the Capitol. I said, we're going to probably have to walk, the closest place is, we're not walking anywhere. He drives up to the Capitol. The African American Capitol Police open the gate, and he drives right up to the building. And I said, okay, well, that's a new experience. And we get out, and then we walk in, and to get back to your question, we walk into the basement of the rotunda, the meeting room was right underneath that, where they're having this joint session. And outside the meeting room, as far as your eye could see, were these blue-suited pinstripe lawyers and lobbyists for the banking industry. Suitcases, notes in hand, you know, well-attired, all leaning against the wall, some sitting on the floor, just waiting like vultures or expected mothers, I don't know, expected fathers, sorry, sitting outside this room waiting for whatever was going to occur in there, whatever was going to be birthed, or whatever feeding frenzy was going to come out of it, sitting there in the halls in their blue suits. And it was almost a joke, because it was almost a Saturday Night Live parody, because they all did have blue suits and white shirts and red ties. And just as far as the eye can see, I've never seen so many lobbyists in one place, sitting out there with clipboards and notes and folios with notes. And then standing outside the room, which was closed to the public, in there was Phil Graham and Bonnie Frank and the House and the Senate Financial Services Banking Committee just hunkered down in this big room. But standing outside of it were two of the biggest Capitol Police men I've ever seen in my life. Huge guys, who just big, muscular. And we walk up, and they're both African American. And Reverend Jackson, I'm going to go in. Yes, Reverend. And they open the door. And the Reverend walks in like he's a U.S. Senator. And I start to walk in with him, and the big old hands go on my chest. And I'm like, Reverend, he's with me. Okay, go ahead. Go in.
I got in too. Chris Morton got in.
But we all sort of packed in with
and then lobbyists say, hey, we're sitting there. It's like these seats behind the members of Congress.
But I go in this room, and it's really, there are some press in there. So it's closed to the public except press, but only staffers and U.S. senators and reps. And the only two seats open for Reverend and I were right behind Phil Graham. And so I'm sort of leaning, saying things to the Reverend's leaning into Phil Graham. So Phil Graham turns and says, let's talk. So we go out. We don't go out into the hall. But there's a broom closet, literally a broom closet full of brooms. That's only about 3 feet by 6 feet. And we go in there, all three of us. And the press follows us out of the room, pissed off all the Hill staffers. And I'm in this room, and I'm too close. My head is too close to Senator Graham than I want it to be. We can feel each other's breaths. And there's Jackson's head. Graham's hitting my head. And I look back in the doorway of this broom closet, and from top to bottom, a press, people sticking their head in. And I'm really getting far afield on this interview, but Reverend Jackson would say, Senator Graham, you know, communities need hope, not dope, and we want to create the opportunity, the what rhymes with opportunity, and he'd just be doing this very poetic thing. And I'd say, Senator Graham, what the Reverend is saying is the section here on CRA that talks about sunshine doesn't create an obligation for insurance companies, really doesn't serve average Americans. And then the Reverend would say, yeah, people don't want a dash, they want the cash, they want to, you know, and he'd do this rhythmic thing again. I'd say, Senator Graham, what the Reverend is saying is, and I'd take another piece of the bill, and so we were having this out-of-body experience conversation. in which Phil Graham had committed to allow us to show him what the impact of responsible lending in Texas and homeowners' developments that have been created as a result of CRA, and why it was good lending and sustainable lending, and why and how the banks made profit. We wanted to introduce them to bankers and the community leaders who use CRA to spur economic development. He committed to having us come down, and he'd walk with us and go see some of those things. And he lied. He never had. Yeah. We followed up, and it was just bullshit to get rid of me and the Reverend. But,
So the end of the story is the industry has a lot of influence.
A lot of influence.
And still does.
And heck, you've been following the articles, I'm sure, as well as I, about how much money they've been spending through this whole period of Dodd-Frank and financial reform. It is the single greatest challenge to our democracy is that, you know, there is freedom of speech, but depending on how much money you have, your speech can be a lot louder than the average person's. And that's what's happening. Corporations are now have the same rights as individual citizens. It's a pretty sad state of affairs. We need a constitutional amendment that takes the money out of elections and limits what can be spent, so that we're really dealing with decision makers, policy makers, who aren't afraid to enforce, to make sure that the regulatory agencies enforce the laws, whether they're around the financial services sector or any other sector, and they're not afraid because they're not dependent upon those institutions for their re-election. That's the problem. You know, community groups get money from banks, you know, everyone from Acorn to us to CRL, to everybody gets money from banks. Mm-hmm. But they're getting money from banks to allegedly to support their mission, mm-hmm. to help people and to do good things. The groups aren't dependent upon those institutions for their job, whereas a member of Congress, if you don't have campaign finance, enough campaign finance to run TV commercials and radio ads and billboards and all the things in the mailings, you become irrelevant. You lose your job. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference. A big difference.
Can I ask you a question now? Yeah. This report's going to come out in December, and obviously we have an election in November, so the climate could be different when this report comes out. From both of your perspectives, what utility could this report have? The report is not going to have recommendations. It's looking backward. What were the causes of the crisis? From where you sit in 5 years,
I think the most important thing, I think the single most important thing I hope this commission does is that it accurately portrays what happens in as simple and plain a language as possible. Not so members of Congress can pull out sound bites or either side can say, well, see, we told you, and, you know, pull this and that out of the report. But that the commission comes out and it's very clear to the American public what happened and why it happened.
Okay.
The fairy tales of people like Jeb Hensarling and in the Wall Street Journal editorials, the fairy tales about what the reinvention and reconstruction of history through their mindset and through, you know, having people like Rush Limbaugh and Dave, is his name Beck? What's his first name?
Limbaugh,
I don't watch him. Being the ones who are purporting to tell the accurate story of what happened, that's as dangerous as anything else, because what has happened is they've mistold a story and provided so much misinformation that people are actually blaming the government for what happened as opposed to the free market. Most people think that's what happened. Oh, there were these affordable housing goals. Nothing could be, when it comes to Fannie's and Freddie's affordable housing goals, there's nothing that can be further from the truth as to why they got into this market. They had the affordable housing goals in 2001 and 2 and 3 and before that.
The 90s, right?
Yeah. They had those goals. They always got passing scores with very rare exceptions. And the goals didn't change in 2003. The only thing that changed for them is they lost $1 trillion worth of market share. And they got into this in a big way. And it wasn't just about securitizing low and moderate income loans for their affordable housing goals. It was about securing any subprime loans they could get.
So the report could be helpful if it also outlines what were not causes. In other words, take some of these
what were not causes and what was the primary cause. If we don't look at what really got us here, what started this, what fed it and got us here, and that includes the lack of regulatory oversight and the lack of even enforcement of existing laws. And there are laws that could have been enforced that would have stopped a lot of this, nipped this in the bud. Mm-hmm. So where it broke down is if we understand the origination, the feeding of this frenzy, the lack of responsibility taken by those who were appointed to be responsible for ensuring integrity in the lending process. That when we understand that, then we understand what we need to do to correct that and going forward. Mm-hmm. And I do think the CFPB is a great start and a great idea as a way of having an agency that it doesn't have, that isn't dependent upon member banks to pay its dues, mm-hmm. or pay its fees or support it for its very existence. You know, the another thing I should mention to you that I didn't mention earlier is there is a superhighway of employment that exists between the regulatory agencies and the private financial services sector that really has to be ended. I mean, Phil Graham himself, you know, the great evildoer that he was, the protector of this system of abuse and of a financial abuse. Here he was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He left that job and 3 months later showed up working for a bank. A bank that got accused by the federal government of, what did UBS do? UBS got accused of lying to the federal government, cheating the federal government. So this is where Senate Banking Committee, the guy who fought against passing laws that outlawed predatory lending, this is where he went, shortly after he left the Senate. And that's also shortly after his wife left the board of directors of Enron when it collapsed. Not that she left, it collapsed, so she lost that gig. You don't hear about these guys. These are his friends, you know. Henseling.
It happens all the time. High regulatory officials go to the bank trade associations.
Triple the salary. The very people who are examining and regulating them, who are looking at doing their exams, knowing that, gee, I may be working or may be applying for a job with these people. You know, their career path, their planned career path is, I work here for 5 years and then I go work for a bank, they triple my salary and make some real money. Mm-hmm.
We should let you go.
I'm fine. I would talk to you all day about this stuff.
I mean, it was, you know, the fairy tale is that it's some working class activists and some minorities convinced the powerful banks to make subprime loans, and that's why the system collapsed. In fact, the working class and the minority activists were warning the banks and Wall Street for years, do not make these unsafe and unsound loans. Please institute anti-predatory lending protections. The activists went to the banks, went to the regulatory agencies, and went to Congress, yelling at the top of their lungs to have safe and sound lending, to strengthen the Community Reinvestment mm-hmm. Act. So then the victim gets blamed. They get blamed. And in fact, it's the system that John eloquently describes, a system that's hungry for profit and greed, that was outside of the regulated, you know, the shadow banking industry that you hear about. It was outside of the regulatory sphere. That really caused this crisis.
I mean, how does...
And the regulators were not only asleep, but in some cases are actually dousing the flames, with gasoline.
The Fair Housing Act, you know, which under the bank regulatory agencies essentially becomes the Fair Lending Act, prohibits discrimination in lending on the basis of race and gender.